everything has a beginning. In 1914, it started with a single shot. In 1939, one country invaded another. Every war has a definite, definable starting point. In the 25 years between the beginning of the First World War and the start of the Second, the world had changed, and so had the nature of war.
President Roosevelt had spoken of serious damage and casualties in the earlier Japanese air raid on America's Pacific naval bases.
It was set to become deadlier through a revolution in military technology. More aggressive, more bloody. These are the voices that the world heard in the final months of the war. The voices of soldiers, sailors, airmen, politicians, and military leaders.
We shall never cease to persevere against them.
The powerful task force of the Pacific Fleet are bombarding Iwo Jima.
Mr. Attlee has welcomed Russia's entry into the war.
Scientists have made the atomic bomb.
These original archive recordings from World War II tell the very real story of the dramatic.
We could see the dust from the earth being sucked up into the air like a vortex.
And climactic days leading up to the surrender of the final member of the Axis of Evil to fight on, Japan.
Today the guns are silent. The entire world lies at peace.
Victory in Japan was coming, but it would take a heavy toll. This is VJ Day 80, Sound Stories. Louis Mountbatten was a famous cousin. He was the second cousin once removed of the King's brother's oldest daughter, the future Queen Elizabeth II. But in August 1943, with the agreement of the Combined Chiefs of Staff, Winston Churchill appointed Admiral Lord Mountbatten as Supreme Allied Commander, Southeast Asia. After entering the war, the Japanese Imperial Army had taken territory after territory in a series of deadly invasions. Now it was time to take them back.
This morning's news of Japan's aggression is of successful countermeasures against the invasion of Malaya. There have also been reports of enemy attacks on Thailand and Hong Kong. At Shanghai, the Japanese have taken over the international waterfront and sunk the British gunboat Petrel. President Roosevelt has spoken of serious damage and casualties in the earlier Japanese air raids on America's Pacific naval bases, and the Japanese are reported to have lost an aircraft carrier and some of their bombers and submarines.
Churchill gave Mountbatten a crucial job: to unite Allied efforts in the Far East and bring unity to the multinational forces known as the Forgotten Army.
Much hard fighting and hard marching lies before us. We're a long way yet from the end, and Japan is still strong and aggressive. But we hold the initiative, and the end is sure. We were never really the Forgotten Front, though it may have seemed to be so. From now on, I can assure you that we shall be more and more in the thoughts of those at home who realize fully what we are doing and what we are achieving.
The date was December 26, 1941. Outside the US Capitol, platoons of soldiers and police stood on high alert. Shortly after noon, British Prime Minister Winston Churchill entered the Senate chamber to address a joint meeting of Congress.
After the outrages they have committed upon us, at Pearl Harbor, in the Pacific Islands, in the Philippines, in Malaya and the Dutch East Indies, they must now know that the stakes for which they have decided to play are mortal. Observe the Russian menace which hangs over Japan. It becomes still more difficult to reconcile Japanese action with prudence or even with sanity.
Churchill and President Roosevelt didn't always agree, but they were united in their determination to defeat the Axis.
What kind of a people do they think we are? Is it possible they do not realize that we shall never cease to persevere against them till they have been taught a lesson which they and the world will never forget?
In their simplest form, wars are a battle between two sides. In reality, they're more complex. Japan had been trying to conquer China since 1937. On December 7th, 1941, facing a disastrous shortage of oil and the risk of losing face, they set in motion a plan that would take World War II to the Pacific Rim and beyond. The Japanese Empire sent 350 aircraft to attack the huge naval fleet based in the key naval port of Pearl Harbor.
In this nation's capital, the Japanese attack on Hawaii and the Philippine Islands, and the torpedo assault on two American cargo ships in the Pacific, have come with an electrifying shock. The joint session of Congress will be held probably as early as tomorrow, at which the President will announce the Japanese attack upon the United States and ask for a declaration of war.
President Roosevelt spoke as he counted the cost of the attack.
No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory.
That's how the sleeping giant of the U.S. was awoken. It was a mistake the Axis would regret, but not until 1945. Why fight such a war? Why lose so many lives in battle? For most, the reason could be summed up in one simple word. Freedom.
God bless you all, says Mr. Churchill, and finishes his speech, and now just listen. All Whitehall, from the Cenotaph to the House of Commons, is one sea of waving hands and handkerchiefs. 30,000 people crowded into one space, cheering him and cheering.
Under 2 months after the war in Europe ended, VE Day was declared. Britain experienced something it hadn't seen in 10 years. In 1935, Conservative leader Stanley Baldwin became Britain's Prime Minister. He retired 2 years later and was succeeded by Neville Chamberlain. Chamberlain stepped down a year into the war in October 1940 to be succeeded by perhaps the only Prime Minister we can remember as leading during the war, Winston Churchill.
We may allow ourselves a brief period of rejoicing, but let us not forget for a moment the toils and efforts that lie ahead. Japan, with all her treachery and greed, remains unsubdued. The injuries she has inflicted upon Great Britain, the United States, and other countries, and her detestable cruelties call for justice and retribution.
Churchill was a wartime prime minister, but as peace broke out, it was time for a general election. No one was more shocked than Churchill himself that he would lose the 1945 election to a Labour victory and their leader, Clement Attlee. For the war's final chapter, Britain would have a new socially reforming leader, a leader focused less on war and almost entirely on peacetime reform.
We'll build a world of freedom, democracy, peace, and social justice.
Iwo Jima was a remote air base. It gave the Japanese air superiority. It made them strong. On February the 19th, 1945, the US began a 35-day fight to turn that advantage against them. The Battle of Iwo Jima saw the United States Marine Corps and Navy land on and eventually captured the islands of Iwo Jima from the Japanese Imperial Army.
We interrupt the program now in progress to bring you a special report from Guam.
Vice Admiral Mark A. Mitcher is in command of a powerful task force of the Pacific Fleet. Surface units of the Pacific Fleet are bombarding Iwo Jima.
The beach that we're going to land on now looks to be very hot from here. We can't see it too well from our position here on this side of the superstructure, but we can see those geysers from bursting mortar shells and artillery shells being tossed up in the air. And also, the land just beyond the water, just inland of the beach itself, seems to be aflame.
It's almost unbelievable. Everything on Iwo Jima is underground or buried in the side of the volcano. Nothing I have seen so far during the time I've spent on this island has been above the ground.
And now we're streaking in to the line of departure. That means we are going to the line from which we will shortly leave. You can hear our motor, the engine of this tank glider, roaring as we move quickly through the water up to a distance of about 2,000 yards from the shore. There's all hell to pay directly ahead of us. The beach looks as though it's practically on fire. Hey, pull out!
First they took the beaches. Then they moved to take the airfield. Finally, they raised a flag at the top of Mount Suribachi. The image of that flag being raised by Marines is one of the most famous photographs of the entire war. But Iwo Jima would take on an even more crucial role in the weeks to come. It would play a part in the attack that would devastate Hiroshima.
Let there be no mistake. We shall completely destroy Japan's power to make war.
Ultimatums. They're often hollow, toothless, meaningless. In 1945, the United States and China delivered the ultimatum to Japan. It was a declaration of the terms for Japan's surrender. It stated, "We will not deviate from them. There are no alternatives." Japan decided to reject the terms. What they couldn't possibly know was that the US had a secret that made this ultimatum the deadliest the world would ever see. President Truman.
It was to spare the Japanese people from utter destruction that the ultimatum of July the 26th was issued at Potsdam. Their leaders promptly rejected that ultimatum. If they do not now accept our terms, they may expect a rain of ruin from the air, the like of which has never been seen on this earth.
Around the same time, the storm clouds were gathering on another front. Now that Nazi Germany was defeated, Russian Premier Stalin fulfilled his promise to the Allies. He declared war on Japan and turned the might of Russian forces towards the Pacific Rim.
Within the hour, Columbia's chief of European correspondents, Edward R. Murrow, reported from London his belief that one of the principal negotiators at Potsdam has stated that his country will go to war with Japan and soon.
This is London. Mr. Attlee has welcomed Russia's entry into the war. Russia becomes the first nation to enter the Pacific War without being attacked. It is presumed here that she has done so for reasons which have traditionally caused nations to declare war. The defense or furtherance of her national interests. But the best opinion here seems to be that Russia would not have entered the war at this stage had she not had reason to believe that the war in the East was nearing its end.
Japan's defiance would cost them 250,000 more lives. Lives that would be lost to just two terrifying bombs.
Sequence start. 3, 2.
The first flight. The discovery of penicillin. Events that shook the world and changed it forever. In 1938, nuclear physicists in Berlin split the atom. It was groundbreaking. 7 years later, the same principle was used to destroy the city of Hiroshima, using a secret new weapon invented in America. The atom bomb was the invention that allowed President Truman to call the Japanese government's bluff over their rejection of the ultimatum for peace. When they said no, he launched the first ever atomic attack.
Scientists, British and American, have made the atomic bomb at last. The first one was dropped on a Japanese city this morning. It was designed for a detonation equal to 20,000 tons of high explosives. That's 2,000 times the power of one of the RAF's 10-ton bombs of orthodox design.
On the morning of the 6th of August, shortly after 8, I saw an enormous flash in the sky. Soon we saw the smoke rising from the farmers' houses. Soon the first refugees came nearer. bleeding with burns and wounds all over their bodies. People groping their way with the help of a cane or creeping over the ground. It was the procession of misery. We saw about one regiment of soldiers, all badly burned, and the majority beyond hope.
Hiroshima went from a vibrant, colorful city to a blinding atomic bright white, then searing yellow, then the roar of explosive thunder, then, eventually, nothing but a deathly gray of ash. Truman wasted no time in threatening Japan with even more devastation, and he desperately sought out to end the 6 years of war.
Well, that was Hiroshima. Let us hope that it meant the end, not only of this war, but of all wars.
Hiroshima drew back the curtain on America's great secret. Project Manhattan had delivered the world's most terrifying weapons. Hiroshima was devastated on August the 6th, but with no surrender in sight from the Japanese government, President Truman ordered another atomic attack just 3 days later on the Japanese city of Nagasaki. One eyewitness to the bomb's detonation was Group Captain Leonard Cheshire.
At the time of the explosion, we were wearing Polaroid welder's glasses. They were so dark that even the tropical sun showed through them as nothing more than a vague pinpoint of light. Even then, the explosion, when eventually it came, was so bright that it had the same effect as if night had been turned into day. A few seconds later, when it was safe to take off our glasses, we looked out towards the target and saw a vast ball of fire. It was about 2,000 feet in the air and half a mile in diameter. This fire, which generated almost 10 million degrees of heat, began rocketing up into the heavens at a speed of something like 20,000 feet a minute. After 15 seconds, the flame had died out and turned into a cloud. Unlike any other phenomenon the world has ever seen, it was possessed of some diabolical activity, as though it were a horrible form of life. Its heat was so great that even at a range of 20 miles, we could see the dust from the earth being sucked up into the air like a vortex.
Both atomic bombs, along with the wider bombing campaign over Japan, was responsible for the deaths of 250,000 people. Weak, bloodied, crippled by the attrition of war, Japan could take no more.
Japan could take no more. Japan could take no more.
5 days after the devastation of the industrial port city of Nagasaki, 8 days after the world's first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, Japan's head of state, the mysterious, remote, and revered 44-year-old Emperor Hirohito, made a rare public declaration on Japanese radio. In a slight, high and faltering voice, it was his surrender.
NBC has interrupted this program to bring you a special bulletin from the Associated Press. Washington, Secretary of the Navy Forrestal, left a conference with President Truman this morning to say that he hopes the surrender of Japan is an actuality, and that he fully expects a development in that respect within 25 or 30 minutes.
7 p.m. Eastern Wartime, Bob Trout reporting. The Japanese have accepted our terms fully. That's the word we've just received from the White House in Washington. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of the Second World War.
The Japanese have accepted our terms fully. That is the word we have just received from the White House in Washington.
The war is over. The Japanese have surrendered. The victory has been won. It's official from the White House. You just heard Bob Trout. This is it, friends. Now it's all over in the Pacific, over in Europe. It's over, friends, save for the white crosses and the memory of those place names you've never heard of before.
Years ago, Japan signed unconditional surrender to the Allies. Just 6 years from the September weekend in which German aggression started the Second World War. Now, as General MacArthur said after the surrender ceremony, the entire world lies quietly at peace.
World War II had reached its horrific conclusion. Just 5 days after Nagasaki was demolished by the second US atomic bomb, the US erupted in a unified celebration of peace.
I'm now broadcasting to you from the White House grounds. Have you heard the flash? I am sure. The Japanese offer of unconditional surrender is official. It has been accepted. President Truman said this: I have received this afternoon a message from the Japanese government in reply to the message forwarded to that government by Secretary of State Burns on August 11th. I deem this reply, the President told us, a full acceptance of the Potsdam Declaration, which specifies the unconditional surrender of Japan.
Victory in Japan, VJ Day, had finally arrived. At the end of the First War, 21 million people had been injured, and 20 million were dead. A horrific, unimaginable number. At the end of World War II, 70 to 85 million were dead. A staggering 50 million of them were civilians. As the world readied itself to celebrate, most people were grieving someone in the community, their street, or their family. But around the United Kingdom, people started to feel hopeful.
This is London. The Prime Minister, the Right Honourable C.R. Attlee.
Japan has today surrendered. The last of our enemies is laid low. Taking full advantage of surprise and treachery, Japanese forces quickly overran the territories of ourselves and our allies in the Far East. And at one time, it appears as though they might even invade the mainland of Australia and advance far into India. But the tide turned, first slowly, then with an ever-increasing speed and violence, as the mighty forces of the United States and of the British Commonwealth and Empire and of their allies and finally of Russia were brought to bear.
We're back now in Piccadilly Circus, into a Piccadilly Circus which now, although it's after midnight here in London, is crowded as it's never been crowded before. There's literally now not a single place where you can get anybody else in. A girl's got up on one of the roofs and started flag waving, and the whole crowd are waving back. And as for if by magic, flags sprout over this great sea of the crowd.
A very great crowd is collected already. Thousands upon thousands of people gathered to share this historic day with the King and Queen.
Here they come. First Her Majesty the Queen, it comes into view. Then the King in the uniform of an Admiral of the Fleet. The two princesses standing on the balcony. Listen to the crowd.
3 months have passed since I asked you to join with me in an act of thanksgiving for the defeat of Germany. We then rejoiced that peace had returned to Europe. But we knew that a strong and relentless enemy still remained to be conquered in Asia. No one could then tell how long or how heavy would prove the struggle that still awaited us. But Japan has surrendered. So let us join in thanking Almighty God that war has ended throughout the world.
As the war ended, the jubilant reaction was unsurprising. Much of the world had lived with fear for 6 years.
Let us pray that one result of the defeat of Japan may be many happy reunions of those who have been long separated from each other.
The end of the war saw a release of anxiety that turned to jubilant happiness.
But I want to remind you all that when we've had this short holiday, we have to turn to work to win the peace as we've won the war.
But still, a war had started with the aggressive and violent invasion of Poland, ended on an even more deadly note. It went from bullets, tanks, and invasion to the dawn of a deadly new era of the nuclear threat.
From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent. Behind that line lie all the capitals of the ancient states of Central and Eastern Europe. Warsaw, Berlin, Prague, Vienna, Budapest, Belgrade, Bucharest, and Sofia. On the other hand, I repulse the idea that a new war is inevitable, still more that it is imminent. It is because I am sure that our fortunes are still in our hands and that we hold the power to save the future.
As Russia reflected on its 18 million dead, tensions between the former wartime allies grew, and within a few years turned back to a new war. This time, it was a Cold War and would last for 46 years. Every war has an end. August the 15th, 1945, 2,194 days after it had started, the war ended. Possible to sum up the essence of the moment, but President Truman came as close as anyone.
Today the guns are silent. A great tragedy has ended. A great victory has been won. The skies no longer rain death. The seas bear only comets. Men everywhere walk upright in the sunlight. The entire world lies quietly at peace. As I look back on the long, tortuous trail, when an entire world lived in fear, when democracy was on the defensive everywhere, when modern civilization trembled in the balance, we have known the bitterness of defeat and the exaltation of triumph. And from both, we have learned there can be no turning back. We must go forward to preserve in peace what we won in war.
And the guns!
Today the guns are silent.
Shout above our heads!
A great tragedy has ended.
And we kiss!
Men everywhere walk upright in the sunlight.
As though nothing could fall.
When modern civilization trembled in the balance.
And the shame.
When an entire world lived in fear.
She was on the other side.
We have known the bitterness of defeat.
When we can be done.
And the exaltation of triumph.
Forever and ever.
There can be no turning back.
And we can be heroes.
We hold the power to save the future.
Just for one day.
VJ Day 80 Sound Stories was narrated by Mark Chadwick, written and produced by Andrew Wright. This program is a tribute to all those who fought and died in the defense of freedom, and to those who still risk everything for that precious, fragile ideal.
Today the guns are silent. The entire world lies at peace.